Knowing what you know, are you comfortable with the idea of your children or family members using TikTok? Thank you.
I've responded to the question first. Well, first of all, look, in 10 years, Russia and China have had 40 meetings. And I disagree with the basic premise of your question. We have significantly expanded our alliances. I haven't seen that happen with China and or Russia or anybody else in the world. We're in a situation in the United States where NATO is stronger. We're all together. The G7, the Quad, the ASEAN, Japan and Korea. I have, my staff point out to me, I have now met with 80% of the world leaders just since I've been president. We're the ones expanding the alliances. The opposition is not. Name for me where that's going. And tell me what I don't mean literally that, but rhetorically. Tell me how, in fact, you see a circumstance where China has made some significant commitment to Russia. And what commitment can they make economically? Economically. Pardon me?
Their trade has increased, sir.
Yeah, their trade has increased compared to what? Look, I don't take China lightly. I don't take Russia lightly. But I think we vastly exaggerate. I've been hearing now for the past 3 months about China is going to provide significant weapons to Russia, and they're going to well, I've been talking about that. They haven't yet. Doesn't mean they won't, but they haven't yet. And if anything's happened, the West has coalesced significantly more. How about the Quad? How about Japan and the United States and South Korea? How about what we've done in terms of AUKUS? How about what we, I mean, so I just want to put it in perspective. I don't take it lightly what China and Russia are doing. And it could get significantly worse. But let's put it in perspective. We are uniting coalitions. We, the United States and Canada.
On TikTok, we made a similar decision to the American government and others when we said that we do not feel that the security profile is safe for government-issued phones. There are concerns around privacy and security, and that is why we have banned TikTok from government-issued phones. But your question, Josh, was about what I do as a parent of teenagers and my kids on social media. And on that, I am obviously concerned with their privacy and their security, which is why I'm glad that on their phones that happen to be issued by the government, they no longer access TikTok. That was a big frustration for them. Really, this applies to us too, Dad? Yes, I just did that. But I think as parents, we are understanding, particularly of teenagers, just how much of our kids' lives are lived online and how much they are impacted, not just by influence the way their friends are and peer pressure that all of us went through as teenagers, but a degree of misinformation, disinformation, and malicious activity that is allowed for by incredible advances in technology that we are benefiting from in so many different ways. As governments, we have to make sure we're doing what we can to keep people safe in the public square, making sure we're pushing back against hate speech and incitations to violence online, and we're carefully calibrating legislation to do that. As a parent, I spend a lot of time talking to my kids about what's online and how they should try and, you know, go outside and play a little more sports and not get so wrapped up in their phones. And we're going to continue to do that. Our concerns around TikTok are around security and access to information that the Chinese government could have to government phones. It's just a personal side benefit that my kids can't use TikTok anymore that I recommend everyone to use my encouragement to try and do.
Merci. On va prendre maintenant la question canadienne. Christiane Hale de Radio-Canada.
We'll now go to a Canadian question.
Mr. President, Nguyen.
Bonjour, Monsieur Trudeau, bonjour.
Good afternoon, j'aimerais Mr.
Vous
President.
Poser d'abord, s'il vous plaît,
Mr. Prime
une question
I'd like
à propos
to ask a question
Roxham.
About Roxham Road.
L'entente était prête depuis
the agreement
un an.
Has been ready
Pourquoi
for a year?
Attendu si longtemps?
Why did you wait
Et pour les 15 000 migrants que
and
Canada
for the 15,000 migrants that Canada will welcome? Why so few? What have we offered to the U.S. in exchange? Thank you, Christian.
On sait depuis longtemps un niveau
We've known
théorique,
for a long time, theoretically, what modernization needed to be made to the Roxham Road, to the agreement. We couldn't simply shut down Roxham Road and hope that everything would resolve itself, because we would have had problems. The border is very long. People would have looked for other places to cross. And so that's why we chose to modernize the Safe Third Country Agreement so that someone who attempts to cross between official crossings will be subject to the principle as someone who should seek asylum in the first safe country they arrive at. Now, for people who are coming from the U.S., that is where they should be asylum seekers. Using this means of uniformly applying the agreement, which we knew theoretically would be the solution, but it takes complex processes to manage the border. It took months before we could move forward with the announcement. But by doing so, we protected the integrity of the system. And we're also continuing to live up to our obligations with respect to asylum seekers. At the same time, we continue to be open to regular migrants, and we will increase the number of asylum seekers who we accept from the hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere, in order to compensate for closing these irregular crossings. Thank you.
Mr. President, this question is for you, but Mr. Trudeau, soit en sentez-vous bien libre de répondre aussi.
Please feel free, Mr. Trudeau, to answer as well.
Monsieur le Président, êtes-vous déçu que le Canada
Are you disappointed that Canada is not part or hasn't taken a bigger role in the multilateral forces in Haiti, and what would you like Canada to do more in addition to the $100 million announced today?
Well, no, I'm not disappointed. Look, this is a very, very difficult circumstance. The idea of how do we deal with what's going on in Haiti, where gangs have essentially taken the place of the government, in effect. They rule the roost, as the saying goes. And so I think that what the Prime Minister has spoken about makes a lot of sense. The biggest thing we could do, and it's going to take time, is to increase the prospect of the police departments in Haiti having the capacity to deal with the problems they're faced. And that is going to take a little bit of time. We also are looking at whether or not the international community through the United Nations could play a larger role in this event, in this circumstance. But there is no question that there is a real, genuine concern, because there are several million people in Haiti, and the diaspora could cause some confusion in the Western Hemisphere. And so, but I think that what the Prime Minister is suggesting, and we are as well going to be contributing, to see if we can both increase the efficiency and capacity of the training and the methods used by the police department, as well as seeing if we can engage other people in the hemisphere, which we've been talking to, and they're prepared to do some. So it's a work in progress.
Depuis 30 ans.
For 30 years, Western countries have been involved in Haiti to try to stabilize the country, to try to help the Pearl of the Antilles, and the situation is atrocious. It's affecting the security of the people of Haiti. We must take action. And we must keep the Haitian people in the approach that we build for security. And that's why the approach that we are working on with the U.S. involves strengthening the capacity of the Haitian National Police, bringing more peace and security and stability. This won't happen tomorrow. It will, of course, be a long process, but we will be there to support the capacity of the police in Haiti, the national police. At the same time, part of the insecurity and instability in Haiti is because of the Haitian elite, who have for too long benefited from the misery of the Haitian people. They work for their own political gain, their own personal gain, and this has prevented the country from recovering. And that's why we're proceeding with sanctions. We will continue to bring pressure to bear on the elite, the political class in Haiti, to hold them accountable for the distress facing the Haitian people, but to hold them accountable for ensuring their well-being. We're going to continue to work together. We fully understand how important this task is.
Mr. President, over to you.
Can I follow up with one point on Haiti? And that is that any decision about military force, which is often raised, we think would have to be done in consultation with the United Nations and with the Haitian government. And so that is not off the table, but that is not in play at the moment. I'm sorry.
Over to you for the question, Mr. President.
Jordan, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. President. Some on Wall Street have expressed frustration that it's unclear what more your administration is willing to do to resolve the banking crisis. The markets have remained in turmoil. So how confident are you that the problem is contained? And if it spreads, what measures such as guaranteeing more deposits are you willing or not willing to take?
First of all, have you ever known Wall Street not in consternation? Number one. Look, I think we've done a pretty damn good job. People's savings are secure, and even those beyond the $250,000, the FDIC is guaranteeing them that the American taxpayer is not going to have to pay a penny. The banks are in pretty good shape. What's going on in Europe isn't a direct consequence of what's happening in the United States. And what we would do is, if we find that there's more instability than appears, we'd be in a position to have the FDIC use the power it has to guarantee those loans above 250, like they did already. And so I think it's going to take a little while for things to just calm down. But I don't see anything that's on the horizon that's about to explode. But I do understand there's an unease about this. And these mid-sized banks have to be able to survive, and I think they'll be able to do that.
And Mr. Prime Minister, the U.S. has included Canada in electric vehicle subsidies, as you've discussed, that were included in the Inflation Reduction Act. But the IRA also raises some competitiveness concerns and challenges for Canada. You know, President Biden supports Buy American provisions very strongly, and that has historically led to some trade tensions. So are you planning to announce anything in your budget to keep up, so to speak? And are you asking the U.S. government for exceptions to the Buy American provisions in other areas?
First of all, there's nothing new about Canada having to make sure that we remain competitive with the United States as a place for investment. That's something that we have long known as a friendly competition between us that has led to tremendous growth and benefits in both of our countries. Right now, we're in a time where Joe talked about it as an inflection point. I think that's exactly right. We can feel the global economy shifting in very real ways towards lower carbon emission technologies, cleaner tech, great jobs in the natural resource and manufacturing industries that are going to be increased on our continent after years of outsourcing and offshoring. There is a real opportunity for both of us. And the IRA, which is bringing in massive investments and massive opportunities for American workers and companies, is also going to have strong impacts on supply chains and producers and employees in Canada. Yes, we're going to have to make sure we're staying competitive and targeting the areas where we think we can best compete, and we'll have more to say about that in our budget next week. But let us take a moment to step back and see that North America, Canada and the United States in particular, are incredibly well-positioned to be the purveyors of solutions and economic growth that the net zero economy around the world will need over the coming decades. The innovation, the know-how, the ability of us to make big things together leave us in a time of global uncertainty extremely certain that we are well placed for the future. Whether it's investments that have seen Canada go from fifth or sixth in the world in terms of battery supply chains to now second in the world in terms of battery supply chains, whether it's continuing our leadership on the cleanest aluminum in the world, moving towards cleaner steel and zero emission steel, whether it's moving forward on critical minerals that the world is understanding they can no longer rely on places like China or Russia for, that they can rely on Canada to be not just a purveyor of ores, but of finished materials that will be built in environmentally responsible, union or good middle class jobs, wages, strong communities, and the kind of leadership that the world is increasingly looking for. There's long been a bit of a weakness, I think, to our argument that we've made over the past decades as Western democracies that says that our model is the best one. It leads to the most prosperity. But so much of our model, we sort of turned our back to the fact that it relied on cheap imports of goods or resources from parts of the world that didn't share our values and weren't responsible on the environment or on human rights or on labor standards. And what we're doing right now is showing that we can and will build resilient supply chains between us and with friends around the world that adhere every step of the way to the values that we live by, that make sure that there are good jobs for workers in communities, urban and rural, right across our continent. There are good careers for kids long into the future, not in spite of a changing world, but because of that changing world and how well we are positioned to see the future and meet the future. That's why it's so exciting to be able to work alongside Joe in these challenging times, where we know we are better positioned than just about anyone else. And those friends of ours who share our values and our democracies around the world will benefit from the strength and the relations they have with us. And those who choose to continue to turn their backs on the environment, on human rights, on the values of freedom and dignity for all, will increasingly not be able to benefit from the growth that our societies, that our communities are creating every single day.
And by the way, we each have what the other needs. We each have what the other needs. The idea that somehow Canada is somehow put at a disadvantage because we're going to probably be investing billions of dollars in their ability to package what is coming out of the semiconductor area, I don't get it. How's that in any way do anything other than hire and bring billions of dollars into Canada? I also don't understand how, when we talk about it, we greatly
need Canada in terms of the minerals that are needed. Well, you guys, we don't have the minerals to mine. You can mine them. You don't want to produce, I mean, you know, turn them into product. We do. I mean, I'm a little confused, at least thus far, on why this is a disadvantage for Canada and the United States. I think we each have what the other needs. And let me conclude by saying, you know, when I started talking about we're going to build our economies from the middle out and the bottom up, not the top down, I was being literal. Because what happened is, if you think about it, in Democrat and Republican administrations beginning over 30 years ago or more in the United States, corporate America decided that what they're going to do is they're going to export jobs and import product because there's cheaper labor. Well, guess what? Now we are making sure they import jobs here, and we export product. Canada's doing the same thing. So this is a real shift in the world economy in terms of what we're prepared to do. And I'll be darned if I'm going to stick in a situation where, as long as I'm president, where we have to rely on a supply chain in the other end of the world that is affected by politics, pandemics, or anything else. We're not hurting anyone in terms of having access to the start of the supply chain. It's available. But again, I predict to you, you're going to see, after we're both out of office, both China out of the game in terms of many of the product they're producing, and the United States and Canada pretty solid economically situated for the future in terms of also bringing back manufacturing jobs. Yes. Sorry. And they're telling me I'm talking too long because we got to go to dinner.
Thank you. On va prendre maintenant dernière question.
We'll take one last question.
My first question is for the Prime Minister, but Mr. President, feel free to weigh in before my follow-up. Prime Minister, we know that you've appointed a special rapporteur, but with what we've learned about Han Dong's communication with the Chinese Consular General, do you believe he advocated for the delayed release of the two Michaels?
First of all, Han gave a strong speech in the House that I recommend people listen to, and we fully accept that he is stepping away from the Liberal caucus in order to vigorously contest these allegations. But I do want to take a step back and point out that foreign interference by authoritarian governments like China, Russia, Iran, and others, is a very real challenge to our democracies and is absolutely unacceptable. It's why over the past number of years, the President and I have had many conversations about this, and indeed, we'll continue to work together with our democratic allies around the world to keep our institutions and our democracies safe from foreign interference. In 2018, when Canada hosted the G7 in Charlevoix, we actually created the G7 Rapid Response Mechanism to protect our democracies in cases of interference. And we will continue to work together to make sure we're doing everything necessary to protect our democracies, which by definition are more open and therefore more vulnerable to foreign actors trying to weigh in our politics, in our business, in our research institutions, and particularly impact on citizens themselves, which is why over the past years, Canada, like our allies around the world, has given itself new, rigorous tools to counter foreign interference. And with the work that our expert rapporteur will do, with the work that our National Security Committee of Parliamentarians will be doing, and other institutions, we will continue to do everything necessary to keep Canadians safe.
Nothing to add.
Thank you. And Mr. President, when you took office, you canceled the Keystone XL pipeline. This week, your government delayed the environmental assessment to reroute Enbridge Line 5. And at the same time, you're approving oil drilling in Alaska. So what's your response to people who say it's hypocritical to stymie Canadian energy projects while allowing your own?
First of all, I don't think it is, but I'll be very brief. The difficult decision was on what we do with the Willow project in Alaska. And my strong inclination was to disapprove of it across the board. But the advice I got from counsel was that if that were the case, I may very well lose in court and lose that case in court to the oil company and then not be able to do what I really want to do beyond that, and that is conserve significant amounts of Alaskan sea and land forever. I was able to see to it that we literally able to conserve millions of acres, not a few, millions of acres of sea and land forever, so it cannot be used in the future. I am banking on, we'll find out, that the oil company is going to say not that's not going to be challenged, and they're going to go with three sites. And the energy that is going to be produced there, estimated, would account to 1%, 1% of the total production of oil in the world. And so I thought it was the better gamble and a hell of a trade-off to have the Arctic Ocean, the Bering Sea, and so many other places off limits forever now. I think we put more land in conservation than any administration since Teddy Roosevelt. I'm not positive of that, but I think that's true.
Thank you all. This is what concludes today's press conference. C'est ce qui met fin à la conférence de presse d'aujourd'hui.
Thank you.
That is the President of the United States alongside Prime Minister Justin Trudeau taking questions from reporters, concluding kind of the formal part of the day. They're heading now to a dinner, a gala. There are people arriving to that gala as we speak, and we're going to show you that in just a little while. I just want to tell you a little bit, you're watching, by the way, a special edition of Power Play, about what we heard from the Prime Minister and the President, a series of announcements at the conclusion of the President's trip, which includes probably most significantly an agreement on the Safe Third Country Agreement, which of course governs the border between our two countries, and has, through a loophole, allowed for people seeking asylum who would at an official point of entry be turned back to the United States to be able to cross into Canada and seek asylum here. As of midnight tonight, police and law enforcement, really, the Prime Minister says, will enforce that agreement across the full border. So that means that people who come in between those official points of entry, he says, will be turned back to the United States and redirected toward an official point of entry. That's especially significant for the Roxham Road border crossing, where in last year, nearly 40,000 people crossed over that border point by foot. And that has been something the federal government has been attempting to negotiate with the United States since, I think, back in 2018 is when I can remember doing the first interview on the subject. We knew defense and security would be a big subject coming into this meeting and into this trip. And certainly there are announcements to reinforce that, specifically around NORAD. Some money that had already been allotted in order to prepare for the reception of F-35s, as well as the modernization of some of our air capabilities, has been, I think, from what I can gather, and I'll try to get some more details on this, more specifically allocated and over a shorter amount of time. So we have some quicker timelines attached to money that was already announced by the federal government, but that is specifically what the United States, rather, had been asking for going into these meetings. A host of other announcements around opioids, for example, a special task force, as well as the Great Lakes and protecting those waters, but the big significant ones certainly around the Safe Third Country and defense spending as well. That press conference followed a fairly substantial address to Parliament by U.S. President Biden. I'm going to show you a quick highlight reel of that, and then we'll get some analysis.
Today I say to you and to all the people of Canada that you will always, always be able to count on the United States of America. We're living in an age of possibilities. Xi Jinping asked me in the Tibetan Plateau, could I define America? And I could have said the same thing if he asked about Canada. I said, yes, one word. And I mean it, one word.
possibilities. Nothing is beyond our capacity. We can do anything. We have to never forget. We must never doubt our capacity. Canada and the United States can do big things. We stand together, do them together, rise together. We're going to write the future together, I promise you.
One of many standing ovations the president got during his speech, his address to Parliament. A number of other ovations for some special guests in the gallery. We'll get to that in a moment. But let's turn first to some analysis of what we heard from the prime minister and the president during this trip and during that press conference. To help us do that, I'm joined by some experts on the subjects we're talking about. John Manley is here. He's a former Liberal deputy prime minister, of course, and foreign affairs minister. He's now a senior business advisor with Bennett Jones. Carrie Buck, Canada's former ambassador to NATO, is here. She's now a senior fellow at the University of Ottawa. Roland Paris, next to her, is a former senior advisor to Prime Minister Trudeau on global affairs and defense, also served as an advisor to NATO's Secretary General and is now a University of Ottawa professor. And retired Lieutenant General Andrew Leslie, a former commander of Canada's Army, chief government whip and Liberal MP. He's now a senior associate with Blue Sky Strategy Group. Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for making the time and your patience. Everything's been a bit delayed today. Mr. Manley, I'm going to start with you, and I'm actually going to pick up not on the announcements, but on I found the answer on the economy from President Biden very interesting. He sort of contested the framing that the IRA is something we have to compete with, or what he's doing with industrial policy is exclusionary to Canada. What did you think of his kind of take on that?
Well, I think there's no surprise there, really, Vashi. I mean, these meetings and these press conferences, joint statements, the speech to Parliament, this is really about atmospherics. The Prime Minister and the President don't sit down very often and go into the details themselves. So I think what the President is trying to say is, if I build the U.S. economy, that rising sea is going to raise the boats on your side of the border as well. It's not a detailed response, and it's not something that we should be very confident in. I think what Canadian governments have learned over the years is that yes, they're our closest friend and ally. Yes, they're our most important trading partner. But we have to look at every detail of every transaction going through their Congress. We have to be on top of them. We have to use relationships at a cabinet level, at a provincial premier to governor level to ensure that we look after Canadian interests. It's as simple as that. But the Prime Minister should be delighted. The atmospherics were beyond expectations.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to jump off that point and ask. If Professor Paris, this is about kind of building those atmospherics, building the relationships, how do you think this trip served that purpose?
This was the speech that most Canadians would want to hear from a U.S. president. Certainly the kind of visit that the prime minister and those around him would have wanted. It's clear that the president was very careful not to say anything that could be construed as negative. My sense is that the president pushed the Roxham Road deal over the finish line for this trip. And I think coming back to John Manley's point, what we heard from Joe Biden today was talking about built in North America. And now this is, what we want to hear, not just from the President of the United States. We want this perception that if we're moving into a world of more industrial policy and more managed economies, that the United States and key people in the U.S. political system and in industry are going to be thinking that we have a shared continental economy. And I think that it was encouraging to hear Joe Biden speaking about that, and hopefully this trip, which is like a 24-hour briefing session, has embedded that idea in his head.
And hopefully it materializes in actual exemptions for Canada under the new rules that he plans to bring in.
Like Mr. Manley said, it's going to take a lot of work for Canada.
Yeah. Ms. Buck, I wanted to ask you about, and Professor Paris highlighted this, but in President Obama's speech, there was a little nudge, right? It was very positive as well, but there was a little nudge, NATO needs more Canada. And certainly that was around the issue of defense spending and hoping that Canada spends more. The White House had signaled they too wanted that they too want to see that. But there was no real nudge in the speech or no deriding of Canada in the speech at all in that vein.
No, I think it was a great message from President Biden. Absolutely positive message. And as Dr. Paris said, no no even shade cast on, against Canada for, frankly, low defense spending. Every American president has pushed Canada to spend more on defense and security. This is a hardy perennial, so this is no surprise. But the world's changed. It's a nastier place now, and there are a lot more threats posed to Canada. And from my perspective, I would have liked to see a bit more new money. It seems from this that it's existing money, particularly for NORAD, maybe with expedited timelines. There's a lot of details there that we have to go through to figure out what actually is going to be expedited, but no new money. We'll see. There's the defense policy update that's supposed to, meant to come sometime soon, and maybe there's something more around continental defense there. But overall, it's still good news, but I wonder if it's enough for the Americans. If they want to see us increase our defense spending, we didn't.
General Leslie, what's your interpretation of what we heard on NORAD? I'm trying to text people in the Department of Defense to find out, but my understanding is it's not new money, it's just expedited in how fast it will be spent. Is that your understanding?
I think it is. These are two professional politicians at the top of their game. They're leaders of our two nations, and they know the stakes. And they're also very good at what they do in terms of spreading love and joy. Mutually to assure that our two nations can progress together. In the defense sphere, there's no doubt that the United States is disappointed with Canada's lack of achieving 2%. There's no doubt that they want us to do better, faster, smarter on investing in the North American Air Defense Agreement. Ukraine came up a lot, so did Haiti. All in all, I think there were some gentle hints and nudges there that were sort of in par with the tone and tenor of the overall success of the meeting.
Mr. Manley, I see you nodding your head there. I was wondering also your impression, and I'll get everyone else to weigh in, on the comments that the president made around a reporter asking about the alliance or the allyship between Canada and the U.S. versus what we saw earlier this week with President Xi and President Putin. The president kind of said he rejected the premise that those allies were growing their friendship, and he kind of dismissed that. But that is kind of a subtext to a lot of what we talk about in the security environment right now. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's correct. The world is becoming a more threatening place, as Ambassador Buck has said. And in part, that's because we're seeing these blocks of interest form. I think U.S. prestige, the events in the last 2 weeks in which China brokered an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran is a major step toward a much bigger role for China to play in the world. I think that we have to see Xi's visit to Moscow as being a consolidation effort by him. Let's face it, this has not gone well for Russia over the last year. In some ways, you could say they're becoming China's gas station. And that's not a prestige. That's not what Vladimir Putin imagined when he thought up to himself about reestablishing the greatness of the Russian Empire. But for President Xi, it's very opportune because he can increase that reliance that Russia has on him. And let's face it, he is building a counterweight to the United States of America as a global power and a global influence. And I think President Biden is well aware of that. He's not going to play it up in a press conference like he had today.
Professor Paris, I know, and I want to acknowledge everyone's time is limited, so we'll do one last round here. Professor Paris, your thoughts on the way in which it was framed by Joe Biden, the China question was framed.
Well, I mean, Joe Biden is an optimistic guy. He's always got a smile, and he has reasons to be optimistic. He has substantive reasons and political reasons to be optimistic. The fact is, the world is changing, as everybody says. We're seeing the emergence of a multipolar world. We're seeing the emergence of a very economically powerful China. And this is part of the context in which all of this conversation about electric vehicle tax credits and critical minerals is taking place. What we're seeing is a very intense competition emerging. And from Canada's perspective, we absolutely need to be inside the tent and not left on the outside like we felt we were, and to some extent we were with Donald Trump. So locking in gains and working for more gains and hoping for the best when it comes to whoever might replace Joe Biden eventually in the White House, all of these things have to be part of our work right now, because this competition isn't going away. It's just going to intensify.
Yeah, and really all the other things that we're talking about here today, like the economy, as Professor Paris points out, or critical minerals or chips and all that stuff, it is against that backdrop. I wanted to highlight, Ms. Buck, and ask you for your take on the fact that at the same time as we're having that conversation, Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig were in the House of Commons today. They will be at the dinner tonight. It was emotional. They got a standing ovation before anyone even entered the room, before the president even came in, then during the prime minister's speech, and then also during the president's speech. What were your takeaways from that?
Well, it was really, for diplomats who've been in the field and who know them, it was really heartwarming to see the response. Not a dry eye in the House. But China's been using hostage diplomacy, and in a way, I think they saw us as an easier target than the U.S. So it's useful to have the president and the prime minister stand up and take common cause around China. Yes, President Biden said that he discounted, I think, some of the growing rapprochement between Russia and China. China's been playing a really careful balancing act. On the one hand, they've been saying things about the unlimited friendship with Russia and President Xi's trip. So that's words. But if you look at the actions, as President Biden said, arms haven't been as expected or as feared.
Yeah,
they haven't been flowing in.
I've been hearing about this for months.
Yeah, but
it hasn't happened.
China's been consistently abstaining at the UN Security Council, the UN General Assembly on Ukraine resolutions. No military alliance or anything concrete appeared to come on the military front, came out of the Xi visit to Moscow. So something to watch. But as Professor Paris said, we need to make sure that Canada and the U.S. align our policies on China, particularly as we decouple on things that are important to our national security, like critical minerals, and that we also work to make sure as many other states are aligned with us as well, because otherwise we lose market share. So it'll be pretty important to have the EU, for instance, come along with us. They're not quite there yet.
Do you have the sense, General Leslie, that will be the case going forward as we look ahead?
I do. This was a friendly, mutually supporting visit. But let's not forget that the United States takes defense extraordinarily seriously, which is why President Biden started his remarks at the press conference by casually mentioning that he's ordered weapon systems to attack Syria to warn off the Iran Revolutionary Guard. He then went on to list 8 or 9 military alliances of which the United States is part. And the fact that the war in Ukraine and Russia's savage actions are something worth fighting for, essentially. So we'll see what happens, what the product of this might be in Canada's response in the budget, because I sincerely hope there's new money for investment in North American air defense and defending our Arctic and trying to achieve somewhat closer to 2% of GDP, and the list goes on. I think that's the issue to watch for now.
Well, we've just got a few days before we'll find out an answer to that. That budget gets tabled Tuesday. I want to thank all four of you for making the time for your analysis and your insights tonight. Thanks to John Manley, Roland Paris, Kerry Buck, and General Andrew Leslie. To recap for you, the Prime Minister and the President are headed to a gala dinner just down the street from here, not too far away. We're going to have full coverage of that dinner tonight. The two just finished taking questions from reporters on a wide variety of subjects. The announcements, however, that came out of this trip are numerous. Most significantly, you heard me talk about it a few minutes ago, there is the Safe Third Country Agreement. That is the agreement between the United States and Canada, actually, that Mr. Manley, our last guest, negotiated years ago, 2 decades ago, in fact, that governs the border and, in particular, has affected the number of people who seek asylum in this country and who do so through a loophole that exists until midnight tonight in the agreement. They are able to cross over that border by foot. We're standing by to get the Immigration Minister, Sean Fraser, who will join me live in a few moments from just outside the gala dinner to get some more insight into what exactly happens as of midnight and what Canada did in exchange to get that agreement from the United States. While we wait for him to get set up and to get the microphone on, I certainly do want to tell you a little bit about other things that we heard from the president. Let's play a clip right now of kind of the central theme of what he said in his address to Parliament, that Canada and the U.S. Share very much so the same values. Have a listen.
Today, our destinies are intertwined and they're inseparable, not because of the inevitability of geography, but because it's a choice we've made again and again. The United States chooses to link our future with Canada because we know that we'll find no better partner. And I mean this from the bottom of my heart. No more reliable ally, no more steady friend. And today I say to you and to all the people of Canada that you will always, always be able to count on the United States of America. I guarantee it.
A lot of applause and a standing ovation once again for the president on that line. He had a number of them just like that, talking about the alliance and the friendship between the United States and Canada. You heard us discuss with the panel a little bit earlier that there was some consternation, some discussion that perhaps there could be a little bit of chiding for Canada, much like President Obama, when he was here in 2016, said that NATO needed more Canada. There was really none of that. There was talk of partnership in the areas of defense and security, and in particular in the economy and climate change, and how the two, from both the vantage point of Prime Minister Trudeau and President Biden, are certainly intertwined. But beyond that, there was not a lot of talk of friction or irritants between our two countries. The president and the prime minister are right now on their way to a gala dinner in the president's honor. During that dinner, they will offer speeches to the audience. There's about 600 people in attendance and a whole slew of Canadians in arts and culture that I'm sure you're very familiar with. Anybody from, I think, Hayden Christensen to Eugene Levy, Sandra Oh, and Sarah Polley. And we're going to have some of that coverage coming up. We're standing by right now to just wait for our country's immigration minister, Sean Fraser, to get hooked up with a microphone, because we're going to be talking to him about a significant announcement coming out of this trip, probably the most significant announcement, and one that not a lot of people were likely expecting if they had listened to comments from the White House in the last few months. It involves the Safe Third Country Agreement and the border between Canada and the United States. Prior to COVID, there had been an issue with people seeking asylum in between official points of entry. They had essentially risked their lives in many cases to cross by foot over the border. After COVID, once the border restrictions were lifted, those asylum seekers continued doing that, and new ones came over. And the volume became such that about a month ago, the premier of Quebec kind of sounded an alarm and said, look, we don't have the capacity to deal with the volume of asylum seekers coming across the border here. In 2022, there were about 39,000 people who crossed the border by foot at Roxham Road to seek asylum here in Canada. Again, it was because of a loophole in the agreement that meant if you do go to an official point of entry, you will be turned back to the United States. But if you cross by foot in between, you can actually come over the border, be intercepted by the RCMP, and go through the process of seeking asylum, the official process of seeking asylum here. So that had been an issue domestically that was a hard one for the federal government, because they had pressure not only from the government in Quebec, but also from the official opposition, from the Conservatives in one vein, and then from the NDP in the other. The agreement itself is actually before the Supreme Court, and the constitutionality of it is being tested. So we'll certainly be able to ask the minister about what should happen in the event of that. But essentially, the agreement will now, as of midnight, apply to the entire border. So we'll wait to hear from the minister on exactly how that will work and what Canada had to do in exchange. In the meantime, I do want to share some of the other moments from President Biden's address to Parliament that really stuck, I think, with me and with a lot of Canadians who were watching. In particular, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, the two Michaels, as they're kind of anecdotally known, who were imprisoned in China, detained in China for more than 1,000 1,000 days. They made their way to Parliament. They were there in the gallery for the president's address. And even before he came in the room, ministers from the government side were urging them to stand up, and they received a standing ovation from the entire room, full of parliamentarians, former prime ministers, former governor generals, just a massive swelling of support for Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor. We have some of the comments that both the prime minister and the president made. We'll start with the president singling out Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor.
Our citizens are not bargaining chips. They're not diplomatic leverage. They're human beings with lives and families that must be respected. And I'm very glad to see the two Michaels. The two Michaels, Michael Scarborough and Michael Kovrig. They're safely back to their families. After more than 1,000 days, 1,000 days in detention. If my mother were here, she'd say, God bless you both. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for having an opportunity to meet you earlier.
And just prior to that, the Prime Minister also highlighted their presence in the gallery as he welcomed President Biden. Have a listen to that.
This is not a moment to compromise on our values. This is a moment to double down on them. We must continue to show resilience, perseverance, and strength. Resilience, perseverance, and strength. These are words that perfectly describe two men who are here with us today, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor.
You can see there a pretty emotional moment in the House of Commons as parliamentarians rise to support for a third time Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor. The two of them will be headed to a gala dinner, which is set to get underway any moment now. That's where we find Immigration Minister Sean Fraser, who's just outside of the room, I believe, that everyone will be dining in. Minister, great pleasure to see you. Thank you for making the time.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Vashi. Thanks for having me.
I imagine it's difficult to hear me, so I do appreciate you making the effort. I just wanted to, you know, the announcement on your file is a very significant one today. Can you explain clearly for Canadians what happens as of midnight tonight?
Certainly. So the Safe Third Country Agreement has been expanded, and as of 12:01 a.m. tomorrow morning, the same rules that currently apply at official points of entry will apply in between points of entry. This means that people who come to make an asylum claim in Canada will be able to do so if they qualify for one of the exemptions, but will not be able to enter into Canada if they had the ability to make an asylum claim in another safe country on the way, in particular with respect to this agreement, the United States. In addition, Canada has agreed to welcome 15,000 newcomers to our country from the region that is primarily responsible for people who are fleeing violence or persecution that are making their way to seek asylum in the first place. We're doing what we can to strengthen the border, but at the same time continue to be welcoming and to build capacity in the region to help address the systemic issue of irregular migration more broadly.
When you say that you're going to welcome 15,000 from those areas that are affected, do you mean, for example, Central America? Like, is it that specific, or are those details not yet finalized?
The program has not yet been developed. I anticipate it will disproportionately reflect migrants from Central and South America, or perhaps Haiti in particular, given the specific country situation that we're dealing with on the ground and the obvious connection between communities in Canada and the people of Haiti. We do have program design details that we need to develop in the next number of weeks, but as we have the information available about how people can qualify for these regular pathways to Canada, we'll of course make them available so people can plan accordingly and avail themselves of the opportunity to seek Canada's protection through regular migration channels.
Your government has been working on this issue, attempting to modernize the agreement for years. I was saying to our panelists, I remember interviewing your predecessor, I think back in 2018, about the issue. Did you think when you left Washington, I think it was a week ago, a week and a half ago, that you would have a deal, an agreement in place today?
Not necessarily. I sense that we had an excellent partner in the United States, and particularly I should say thank you to Secretary Mayorkas for his leadership on this file. But where things really started to move from my point of view was after we had a conversation not just about the Safe Third Country Agreement or Roxham Road, but we communicated Canada's desire to be a supportive partner on the issue of irregular migration more broadly. We actually had a follow-up conversation about 2 weeks ago, a little bit less in fact, where we had the opportunity to discuss what further options Canada has to continue to support the United States and the hemisphere more broadly, including the possibility of welcoming more people through regular channels. It was during that follow-up conversation that I felt confident we were going to be able to land an agreement in advance of this visit, which I did not think, frankly, was likely to happen before that particular moment. We should also expect that despite the fact we've made significant progress on this file with the conclusion of the Safe Third Country Agreement negotiations, that this is an issue we're going to have to continue to wrestle with. The global trend is that migration will continue to become an increasing challenge in the years ahead. So in addition to welcoming 15,000 people to Canada, we need to be making the investments to help build capacity in the region to develop asylum systems in other parts of the world and also provide people with information about how they can take advantage of pathways that do open up to protect some of the world's most vulnerable.
Are you concerned at all about the people who will now be turned back to the United States and the reasons that they were leaving there and trying to seek their asylum in Canada versus the United States? Like, if they don't feel that they'll be able to get the kind of protections and life that they were hoping for in the United States, and that's why they were coming here, but now we're going to turn them back. Are you concerned about, and are there any sort of mitigating efforts in place to try and help them, really?
Certainly, we're concerned about the well-being of vulnerable people who, regardless of which country they may be landing in or passing through, who don't have an opportunity to stay in their home country. We need to do more to continue to address this issue at the source by tackling the reasons why people flee in the first place. But we're going to continue to review our practices and policies to see how we can continue to be one of the most welcoming countries in the world. But one of the things that we wanted to signal with our commitment to welcome at least an additional 15,000 people from the region is that there are opportunities to seek Canada's protection. But doing it in an irregular and unorganized way puts pressure on communities that do not allow us to treat people with the respect and dignity that they deserve. When people enter Canada in an irregular way, it puts enormous pressure on communities and on social services and on the healthcare system and on the education system. If we can plan accordingly and welcome people through regular channels and communicate the legal pathways people can take to migrate through these regular channels to Canada, we'll be able not only to welcome a larger number of people, but to treat them with a greater degree of dignity and respect by providing them with the very basics that they need, including supports that will help them integrate more successfully into communities. We're going to continue to review the impact of the changes to the agreement in the weeks and months ahead in hopes we can treat people with the respect they deserve.
I was just going to say respectfully, Minister, that if they do go through the regular channels, I mean, what the Safe Third Country Agreement stipulates is that they will be turned back, right? Like, even if they are seeking asylum, they come to the border at an official point of entry, the agreement dictates that they're going to be turned back to the United States. So it's not, you know, I take your point on how they could go through official channels, but if they really won't.
It's important that we understand the reason why we're able to treat the United States as a party to the Safe Third Country Agreement. The United States has one of the most robust asylum systems of any country in the world. We're going to continue to work with them as a partner, but we want to maintain the principle that when a person flees for very good reason from their country of origin to seek the protection in another country, the practice that we're trying to promote is to make an asylum claim in the first country where they're safe. If their desire is to come to Canada, we want to promote the idea that you should use regular migration channels. These are extremely challenging circumstances that people are facing, but by working with the United States to make sure that we continuously review one another's asylum system, we can ensure that we're dealing with people who have an opportunity to make a claim in the country where they're first safe. And of course, there are exemptions to the deal for people who have family members who are in Canada, unaccompanied minors, and other categories. For those who it may not make sense to make an asylum claim in the United States, that there'll be a residual ability to pursue asylum in Canada. There are no such things as perfect solutions when it comes to a global challenge of irregular migration, but I'm convinced that the agreement that we've reached with the United States is going to help prevent so many people from making the decision to take a long and often perilous journey that threatens the lives and well-being of themselves and their families as well.
Okay, Minister, I'm going to leave it there. I'm out of time. Thank you very much for your time, and enjoy the dinner tonight. Thank you.
Pleasure as always. Thank you for having me, Vashi.
Immigration Minister Sean Fraser there telling us a little bit more about what is basically the most significant announcement to come out of U.S. President Joe Biden's visit here. The Safe Third Country Agreement between our two countries will now apply, as of midnight, you heard the minister say, to the entire border. What that means is if you were previously going to use a loophole in the agreement to cross by foot in between official points of entry, as 39,000 people did at Roxham Road last year, you will now be turned away and redirected back to an official point of entry. The agreement applies basically to the whole border, so you will essentially be turned back to seek asylum in the United States. That agreement does face a test of constitutionality before the Supreme Court, so that's something we're going to have to watch as well. But all eyes tonight are at actually where Minister Fraser was. That's the big gala dinner. The president is set to arrive any moment alongside his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, and the prime minister and his wife. We're going to have full coverage here on CTV News Channel. That does it for me tonight. Thanks so much for watching this special edition of Power Play. Up next, the debate with Mike LeCouture. Have a great evening.